And now I ask our brother Brian to come and speak to us. Yahweh alone will be exalted in that day.
Dear brother Phil and my beloved brethren and sisters and young people, we're really living in some remarkable times. At the present time, my dear brothers and sisters, and several things that have happened just in very recent times are incredibly significant and interesting to us. For example, did you see the headline this morning in the Advertiser? It had the Lithuanians pleading to the world for help, and the plea falling upon deaf ears. One would have thought that here was an opportunity to give support to a people that, in a different atmosphere, and with the Soviet Union endeavouring to appear as democratic, that here was every good reason for a world that believes in democracy to say to the Lithuanians, we are with you, 100%. But it hasn't happened. In fact, I don't know that there's a country that has recognised as yet the independence of Lithuania. If ever there was a classic opportunity for somebody to stand up and to show themselves as strong on the behalf of what they claim is the religion of their politics, then surely it ought to be now. Why is that? Why haven't they? It's of course because Mr. Gorbachev is a very popular figure, and the world thinks that it needs Mr. Gorbachev at the moment. And they fear that if the Soviet Union begins to break up, then who will create the stability of the world that's necessary? So Lithuania, in drastic need, under the oppressive foot of the Russians all these 40-odd years, you can cry in vain in your hour of need, but it so suits us at the moment to not hear your cry. You know, the world will pay for things like that, won't it? And it's evidence again to us, my dear brothers and sisters, that our concept of the Soviet Union and of the Gog that Ezekiel describes is correct, never mind how it might presently seem. Mr. Gorbachev has been seen as a very smiling, friendly, democratic, reasonable, emancipating man. But underneath, we must remember that he was brought up in the Stalin era, that his protege was none other than Mr. Andropov, who was considered to be a second only to Stalin in terms of cruelty and connivance in the Soviet Union. Mr. Andropov was that dark-glassed, rather tallish man who at 72 or 74 took over the reins of government from the time of Brezhnev. He only lasted, you might remember, for a year, for he was found to be ill and he died, and Mr. Shenenko took over. But he was a very cunning, conniving and desperate man. And it was under him that Mr. Gorbachev obtained his great elevation to the top ranks of the Soviet Union. So that's his mentor. Don't expect from Mr. Gorbachev free ice creams. He's just not built that way. He may smile for the moment, but if you want to know what he's really made up of, look at what he's achieved in such a time. He's a very strong, resourceful, determined man. And now, having just got the presidency, only what, a fortnight or 2.5 weeks ago, he now has turned his back on Lithuania, as he said shortly after, what you've done is illegal, don't even talk to me about it. And he won't talk to them. Instead of talking, he sent tanks, and they today have taken over the principal buildings in Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania. That's a very interesting sign to us that Russia still has her innate strength, as we might expect. Last week, Time magazine had an article, its leading article, which was upon Berlin. I suppose we've all got some concept of where Berlin stands in the Germany of today. If this is West Germany, and hugging up fairly close to it is East Germany, Berlin is a city about here, and it's joined, or it has an opening, to West Germany by that corridor.
which is nothing more than a highway, an autobahn, as they call them in Germany. But when the Russians and the Allies were determining the status of Berlin, neither was prepared to give up the city to the other. And so, as the country had been divided in two, so they divided the city into two. And it ended up something like that. So this then became known as East Berlin, and that as West Berlin. East Berlin in East Germany, and the capital of East Germany, and West Berlin also in East Germany, but really a part of West Germany. And when that happened, it probably was foreseen that what that would cause is a continual agitation. You had a divided city with part of its inhabitants having allegiance to this part of the country. It was a perfect memento, if you might say, that might have future political implications to drawing those two countries together. Now, of course, that's what's happening. These want it and these want it. So never mind what the rest of the world might think, they're undoubtedly going to take down the border and it will develop into one nation. Now, what would be the capital of a united Germany? Without question, everybody says Berlin will be the capital. You know, the capital of West Germany today is a city called Bonn, isn't it? I can't just think where Bonn is. It's about somewhere like that, isn't it? Somewhere like that in the country. Well, that's the city of Bonn. But it's not going to be so bonny in the future, because, in fact, it's obviously going to lose the capital to the greatest city of Berlin, which has 4 million inhabitants at this time. Bonn only has 300,000, but all the principal government buildings were all being built in Bonn. Now, of course, they won't be built there, and those that were scheduled have been stopped, and there is a real anticipation that Berlin will become the capital of Germany. Now, if that's the case, what's the effect of that? What that's done, if we can take down the middle wall of partition, we now have a large city and an historic city, and the centre of gravity, undoubtedly, of Europe. For everyone feels that Germany, with its great strength economically and its potential in every possible way, leadership and so on, everybody sees Germany as being the centre of Europe once more. So if that's the case, then Germany's capital becomes, as it were, the centre of Europe. Now, if that's the case, Berlin becomes the centre of Europe. And so the Time magazine ran an article which said that Germans increasingly sense that Berlin is becoming the centre of gravity of Europe. The centre of gravity of Europe. Isn't that interesting? Gog of the land of Magog. There has to be a union of the force which is east with the power that is in the centre of Europe. That's the concept. And now we're seeing, just in this last, few weeks, we're seeing the Europeans themselves sense. They're not looking to Paris. They're not even looking to capital of Belgium, Brussels, where the ECM headquarters are, the European Common Market headquarters are. It's this city now that's becoming the fascination of Europeans, which means the centre of gravity, you see, has shifted dramatically to the east, just like you and I would think it should. Isn't that interesting? Extremely interesting. Well, all that excitement in Europe, what about poor Israel? You know, we had an election here and it was despairing enough. Finally, there might be a government formed out of it by the end of the week, if we're lucky. And from that, of course, there comes a sort of lame duck government, because it gets through by just
few hundred votes here and a few hundred votes there, which is not really the kind of decision which creates leadership. And so the nation feels somewhat flattened by the experience. But what about Israel? In all the desperation of their circumstances, they had a government that was made up of joint parties. There was the Likud and there was the Labour groups, and they came together. And then America says, here's a plan by which we want you to talk to the Arabs and give back some land in turn for peace. And that has absolutely ruined their government. Because you've got the Likud, the more conservative people that say, not in your life will we give back land. Why should we give land? Children of Abraham, that's their argument in the cabinet. Why should we give back land to the Arabs who only want to destroy us? You'd have to be crazy even to think about it. No, go and build colonies. Build new cities all through the West Bank. You know, that's what I would think. Absolutely, I'd think that. Why, if we lived all on York Peninsula, it's not much bigger than that. And somebody came to us and said, give all the stretch from Kadena down to Maitland. Give it all away. Would you think that'd be wise? When you put it in that context, you think you'd have to be crazy. Well, that's what the world's asking Israel to do. And putting pressure on. And there's that little man, Shemiah, trying to withstand all that pressure. Not only a pressure from the world outside, but now pressure from within Israel itself. Because many of the people of Israel, of course, have no vision as to what God gave them in the past, or to whom this land might truly belong. They're there just simply as men and women who are Jews, not children of the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. And so their government now is in ruins, and they don't know where they're going. In the meantime, in Europe, there is this burgeoning sense of unity, where now even Lithuania can cry in vain, and all of these Western democratic countries that have so worked to form some reasonable accord with Russia and to tell Russia that she should open her doors to the world and that she should give a voice to her people. And finally she seems to have done it. And then Lithuania puts her to the test, and you can listen to Western Europe and you won't hear a murmur. No one will give her help in the time when she needs it. And so there's this big, big sense of unity and coming together, enormous potential, and sitting underneath that, and all of its trouble, is poor little Israel. Is not this a brand plucked out of the fire? You know, sometimes I think of Israel and you see the hardness of their heart. I can remember very well being in Israel a couple of years ago and thinking, this people have learned nothing in 1900 years. And it's tragic. You know, we are not in favour of the attitudes of Israel. Not at all. And yet in the other hand, my dear brothers and sisters, it is a remarkable thing, isn't it? That they are there back in the land. What an amazing and precious thing that is. So even in their infidelity, in their lack of response to the Lord Jesus Christ, which we grieve for that, we do not condone it one whit, yet nevertheless we are restrained in our attitude to Israel, for it is indeed a precious thing that they have come back to be in the earth again. And I finally wanted to tell you one extremely interesting little story, which just shows a very wonderful historic connection. Very recently, the authorities came to Brother Leslie Johnson and his wife, who are living in Israel. They have a unit there. And they said, you've got 12 hours to leave. And he said, why? What have we done? Well, you haven't done anything. We just are desperate for accommodation. Because all of the Jewish people from Russia are coming back, and they're expecting 70,000 this year. They've never had anything like that for years. They're desperate. They're trying to put people into anything they can find. Schoolrooms, schoolhouses, anything they could find. So, of course, if there are Gentile people in their country who do not necessarily need to be there, they say, please go home. And they said, you've got 12 hours to leave the country. He said, but I can't leave in 12 hours. How can I possibly do that? And they said, look, there's no deal. You've just got to leave in 12 hours. So he pleaded them with them for 24, and after some time they agreed to that. And when they had gone, he rang Brother Jeff Berry here in South Australia. And he said, Jeff, because Jeff must apparently keep connection with him because of all the goodwill that is sent to Israel in garments and other things, and said, "Jeff, this is what I've been told. And I consider it a great calamity. We will have no place here for Christadelphians to come, and all of the work will stop." So Jeff rang the Australian ambassador, Israel's ambassador, and said to him, "This is the predicament. Is this the way that we, after all that we've done with the children of Israel, are to be treated by Israel?" And the ambassador was greatly offended by the circumstance, and he rang in Jerusalem and consulted with the authorities. And within the 24-hour period, they came round, tail between their legs, and said to Leslie Johnson, "You've got 12 months. And they changed his status from being whatever it was, a traveller or something, visitor, to being a helper of Israel. Now, isn't that lovely? And that's because, my dear brothers and sisters, we all, when that little tin goes around, we put some money in it, and therefore, as our Father in heaven can see, we do consider what is there very precious. Though it be hard of heart, yet nevertheless it's a wonderful thing that they've come back. And we can have some thankfulness and, in the right sense, some glory in the privilege which God has given us. Helpers of Israel. So when you go to Israel, there's still a place to stay. Some of our brethren and sisters are using that very same accommodation, aren't they, this year? Fancy looking at Isaiah chapter 2 at a study class. Heard no doubt a thousand times at lectures, but tonight we're going to look at it as a study. We're going to have a good look at some of its expressions, which so often we read at a lecture for the purposes of showing the glory of Jerusalem, the centre of the future earth, the centre of gravity of the whole earth. But tonight we're looking at it as a study. Now, you probably noticed immediately that there are two principal sections. Verses 1 to 5 are visionary. They set before us a magnificent picture of Jerusalem in its glory. Jerusalem in its glory. It's no doubt that section of Isaiah 2 that we remember this chapter 4, isn't it? But in verses 6 to 9, there's a horrendous denunciation of the people of Israel for their idolatry and their materialism. And one wonders, however, is that linked with the former verses? And then, in verses 10 to 22, there is a judgment of God. "Enter into the rock and hide thee in the dust for fear of Yahweh and for the glory of his majesty. The lofty looks of man shall be humbled, and the haughtiness of men shall be bowed down, and Yahweh alone shall be exalted in that day." Now, we probably apply those things all through to the future, don't we? Like we do verses 1 to 5. And no doubt that's correct. The final and greatest application of chapter 2 undoubtedly is to those things that are yet to come to pass. But it's no doubt going to be very interesting to us tonight to see that within the context of Isaiah's day, there were very interesting applications of these words. Never, of course, blanketing out the ultimate application, but nevertheless foreshadowing what that was to come. Now, I've made a list here of different items in this chapter which relate us to the days of Isaiah. And let me just make a summary of the timing of these chapters. You remember that we said with chapter 1 that we believed that the echoes really fitted the days of Ahaz, didn't we? That incorrigible man, that never mind how many times or how deeply he'd be hurt by God, bruised by God, yet he would never learn. And in his weakness and in his poverty, in the nakedness of his nation, he yet went to the gods of the Assyrians that had brought judgment upon him. And he said, "Well, if they can beat us, their gods must be greater." And so he was hurt all the more. That incorrigible man. Well, that's chapter 1, isn't it? "Why would ye be stricken any more? Yet ye will revolt more and more. The whole head is sick and the whole heart faint. from the sole of the foot even unto the head there is no soundness in it but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. Your country is desolate, verse 7. And that fits perfectly the description that we have in the 2 Chronicles 28 concerning Ahaz. Concerning Ahaz, who made Judah to be very low. But when we come to chapter 2, to chapter 5, there's almost no question about it that they relate to the days of the first of the kings
in which Isaiah prophesied. Now, you remember the four kings? What were the four kings in the prophecy of Isaiah, in the days of the prophet? What was the first one?
Azariah.
That's right. Otherwise known as Azariah. Right, and his son? Thank you. And his son? And great king Hezekiah. So there was light on the horizon, wasn't there? And this man was a man of very great works. Now I want you to come back to his times and compare those with the phrases which we have in chapters 2, 3, 4 and 5. But before we do, just turn over to chapter 6, verse 1, because this might help you a lot to see the likelihood of what we're presenting. Isaiah 6 and verse 1, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw also Yahweh sitting upon a throne. So it would be even natural, wouldn't it, to think, well, that which came before 6 verse 1 had relationship to the days of Isaiah. Alright? Now, let's see if some of the features of these four chapters, 2, 3, 4 and 5, can compare with the record of Isaiah's life. Well, we take up 2 Chronicles 26, keeping our hand in Isaiah. We remember in the 2 Chronicles 26 that Isaiah's time was a time of tremendous activity, of vindication over the surrounding nations, of wealth within the nation, of power within its armaments, of great numbers in its army. Just as a summary, we read in verses 9 and 10 of Isaiah, who built towers in Jerusalem at the corner gate and at the valley gate and at the turning of the wall, and fortified them. Also he built towers in the desert and digged many wells, for he had much cattle both in the low country and in the plains, husbandmen also, and vine dressers in the mountains and in Carmel, for he loved husbandry. Moreover, Isaiah had a host of fighting men that went out to war by bands, according to the number of their account, by the hand of Jeiel the scribe, and Maaseiah the ruler, under the hand of Hananiah, one of the king's captains. Then it goes on to describe the tremendous numbers of people that were in his forces. Now, keep your hand there and have a look at chapter 2 of Isaiah. Their land, verse 7, is full of silver and gold. Neither is there any end of their treasures. Their land also is full of horses. Neither is there any end of their chariots. It was a time of tremendous prosperity and ease and glory. In Isaiah chapter 3, verse 16, we have that famous section, verses 16 to 23, which speaks about all of the luxurious ornaments of the women that would even make Rundle Mall blush today to read the number of things which the children of Judah were wearing, or the daughters of Judah were wearing at that time. They stretch forth their necks, verse 16, and wanton eyes,
walking and mincing as they go and making a twinkling with their feet. It goes on to speak of all of their ornaments in verse 18, 19, 20, their bonnets and their ornaments of the legs and the headbands and the tablets and the earrings, the rings and the nose jewels. Thank goodness we haven't got those. The changeable suits of apparel and the mantles and the wimples and the crisping pins and so on. Like you could hardly imagine it. It was Max Factor of old indeed. All the things that have been thought up today have all been thought up and perhaps more in the past. But you see, that doesn't happen in the Depression years, does it? You didn't get that in Australia in the Depression years. You get it when it's an age like this one, where there's money to burn and people are just thinking of any foolish, luxurious item upon which they can spend their surplus money. In chapter 2 of Isaiah and verse 16, there is a most interesting reference to the ships of Tarshish and upon all pleasant pictures. The judgment of God was going to fall upon the ships of Tarshish. Why ever should that be mentioned in the days of Isaiah? Well, if we come back to 2 Kings chapter 14 and verse 22, we find out that this resourceful Isaiah was another one who had interests in the sea. It says in verse 22, he built Elath and restored it to Judah. After that, the king slept with his fathers. Now, you remember where Elath was? It was right down the bottom of the country. You know how that the Red Sea comes up as a slip, and right at the top of the Red Sea, the tongue of the Red Sea, is the little port of Eilat, spelt like that today. And alongside it, in what is now known as Jordanian territory, is the other sister city of, what do they call it today? It used to be called Ezion Geber. Ezion Geber. And what's it called today? Aqaba. Taking off that name of old, you see. Well, in the days of some of Judah's kings, they did have use for that port. Do you think they went down there because they were going to grow potatoes down there? Do you think that, Frank? Why do you think that he built Elath? Nice place for swimming. You see, he only built that because, of course, he was interested in trading. Israel was very prosperous during this time, and so new ventures were tried out. And there were three kings who did that. Can you remember who the other kings were who used the port of Elath and had ships? Solomon. Who was the next one? Do you remember Jehoshaphat? He did that. And the third one was Azariah, or Azariah. Those three kings all seem to have had access to the sea. They're the only kings of Judah of which that is mentioned. Isn't it interesting that it speaks here of a judgment upon the ships of Tarshish in the context of their idolatry? Idolatry that was mixed up with the East and the Philistines. You see, there was an overtone in the local circumstances within the prophecy itself. And so that would answer that. We've got the city being built, obviously, because there was a relationship established, as in the days of old, between the ships of Tarshish and Isaiah. Come to 2 Chronicles 26 again. I don't think in all of the Old Testament, apart from perhaps the exception of Solomon, there's any reference to such a phenomenal fighting force as in the days of Isaiah. In fact, there's nothing like it even in the days of Solomon. The 2 Chronicles 26 and verse 11, moreover, Isaiah had a host of fighting men. We've read about those bands before in verse 11. The whole number of the chief of the fathers of the mighty men of valor were 2,600. In other words, the military was standing, permanent, well organized and well known. And under their hand was an army, 300,000 and 7,500, that made war with mighty power to help the king against the enemy. And Isaiah prepared for them throughout all the hosts, shields and spears and helmets and habergeons and bows and slings to cast stones. And he made in Jerusalem engines invented by cunning men to be on the towers and upon the bulwarks, to shoot arrows and great stones withal. And his name spread far abroad, for he was marvellously helped, until he was strong. Now that description, you go through the record of the kings and see if you can find anything that's equivalent to that. The only comparison is in the days of Jehoshaphat or in the days of Solomon. And so Judah now, having been so much longer entrenched upon the land, probably hit one of the greatest periods of their prosperity and their strength under the great king Uzziah. Now you come back to Isaiah's prophecy. Keeping our hand there, it all begins to make a lot more sense. In the second chapter of Isaiah and verse 7, it speaks, doesn't it, of their land being full of silver and gold treasures. Their land is also full of horses. Neither is there any end of their chariots. That's Solomon all over again, isn't it? So he's copying what Solomon had done of old and the mistakes of it. And in that mighty power which he had set up to deal with the enemy, no doubt there were these features involved. Full of horses and no end of their chariots. That was a time when Isaiah was speaking. It's Isaiah's period of reign which fits that to a T. Again in verse 15. And upon every high tower will the judgment of God be. Upon every high tower and upon every fenced wall. That again implies that when the prophet was speaking, there was a tremendous accent upon strength, physical, material strength. Well, in the record of his life, the king that brought that out, of course, was King Uzziah. In the record of Chronicles, it spoke about he made in Jerusalem engines invented by cunning men to be on the towers and upon the bulwarks. In other words, he had military engineers, as we would call it. Men who would skillfully work out certain types of weapons that were superior to those of the other countries round about. In Isaiah chapter 3 and verse 3, it speaks of similar items. It says there, the captain of 50 and the honourable man. See, the captain of 50 is a military person. You wouldn't speak like that. I can't think of the term being used elsewhere in the prophets at all. But it obviously meant that that person was known. It was a notable feature of the time. The captain of 50 and the honourable man and the counsellor and the cunning artificer and the eloquent orator. So they were times of great activity and of capacity and of engineering skills and of cunning artificing. So Judah at this time was known for her skills and her inventions. Very interesting, isn't it? In the 2nd of Chronicles 26 and verse 16, we have that significant statement which shadows the whole life of Uzziah. For when he was strong, his heart was lifted up to his destruction. His heart was lifted up. That phrase you can lift up out of the record because it's the key phrase, unfortunately, that marks the whole reign of Uzziah, and both before and after his leprosy. Now, when we come over to the record in Isaiah, we find that that phrase is all over the place. In the second of Isaiah, verse 12, it says, for the day of Yahweh of hosts shall be upon everyone that is proud and lofty. And the king was the hallmark of all of that. And upon everyone that is lifted up. he shall be brought low. And because of the king's arrogance that had tended to breathe the same spirit into his elders and his counselors, as you can imagine, they would be very important people in the most prestigious court, and so they were swept up with this fleshly pride, and the people below them and so on, the whole nation is caught up and lifted up in an exaltation that was not godly, not God-fearing. In Isaiah 2, that phrase goes on and on. It's again there in verse 13. And upon all the cedars of Lebanon that are high and lifted up. It's the same word. Verse 14. And upon all the high mountains, upon all the hills that are lifted up. So you can see that is a very close connection with the whole atmosphere of those times. Again in verse 17, the loftiness of man shall be bowed down. The lofty looks in verse 11, when Isaiah was challenged by the high priest rightly, he had a very haughty reply to the prophet. Before he could get the words out there, he was struck with leprosy. So the pride of the king had run right through the people. Chapter 3 of Isaiah and verse 16. Moreover, Yahweh said, because the daughters of Zion are haughty and walk with stretched forth necks and wanton eyes. It was a day of pride. Chapter 5 and verse 15. And the mean man shall be brought down, and the mighty man shall be humbled, and the eyes of the lofty shall be humbled. And so we have in chapter 6, verse 1, in contrast to that, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw also Yahweh sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up. That's the same phrase. And that's like the end of the story almost, isn't it? There was a king who foolishly exalted himself, but God did have one who he would lift up and exalt when he had debased himself. And so the rest of that vision in Isaiah 6 shows that purpose. But come quickly back though to Isaiah chapter 2, because that one will come into a city, and that city has been humbled like its king. And in chapter 2 and verse 2 we read, it's the same word halfway through that verse, Yahweh's house shall be established, and the top of the mountains shall be exalted, lifted up above the hills. The same word. So there's a real theme there, isn't there, which is full of interest to us. Why should it be that chapter 2 then has this magnificent vision? Well, we just turn back to chapter 1, verse 20. We will see that that's what it had been in the past. Well, it had been a great city. How has the faithful city become a harlot? It was full of judgment, righteousness lodged in it, but now murderous. It was what Isaiah says it will become. It will become a city that is known for its justice and its righteousness. It was that in the past. It was full of judgment, righteousness lodged in it. It was the faithful city in the days of David and Solomon and Jehoshaphat and Asa and kings like that. It was like no other city in all the earth. And that, but in verse 22 he says, verse 21, now it is full of murderers. Thy silver is become dross, thy wine mixed with water. Jeremiah in his 6th chapter and verse 30 speaks about Jerusalem as being reprobate silver. You know how that silver was refined? They used to boil the silver and the impurities would come to the surface, and then they would ladle those off to the side until eventually they were able to see the reflection of the purifier in the surface of the silver. Thy silver is become dross. It's not true. It's not sincere. Thy wine mixed with water. Insipid wine, of course, is no relish to anyone. It isn't sincere. It isn't matured. It's not genuine. And so this faithful city is now one of adultery and of murderers. There's a harlot there, and there's murderers in what was the faithful city. Thy silver is dross, thy wine mingled with water. Thy princes are rebellious and companions of thieves. Everyone loveth gifts and followeth after rewards. This is the state of Jerusalem for which a vision of the future was needed. They judge not the fatherless, neither doth the cause of the widow come unto them, like he had already said in verse 17. And which also strikes an echo for us, doesn't it? For it might not just be the fatherless and the widows, but there are lots of causes that come along from time to time, and some that are all with us, where people do not have the companionship which they once used to enjoy. And in those circumstances, we either shoulder that and continually remember them, or we go on with our own ways and we fall away from concern for those who are in those circumstances. And the prophet indicts them for their willfulness and their selfishness. Therefore, verse 24, saith the Lord Yahweh of hosts, the mighty one of Israel, I will ease me of mine adversaries and avenge me of mine enemies. And you know, when he said those words, he took up Moses' words quickly in Deuteronomy 32. This was the condition of the city of Jerusalem. Deuteronomy 32. And verse 41, if I wet my glittering sword and mine hand take hold on judgment, I will render vengeance to mine enemies and will reward them that hate me. I make mine arrows drunk with blood, and my sword shall devour flesh, and that with the blood of the slain and of the captives from the beginning of revenges upon the enemy. See the reiteration of phrases, enemies and vengeance and rendering vengeance. Rejoice, O ye nations, with his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants and will render vengeance to his adversaries. And no doubt when Israel read that, they thought, that's okay for us because it all applies to the Gentiles, because it goes on to say, and I'll be merciful unto and will be merciful unto his land and to his people. So we're okay, long as we're Jews and we live in the land of Israel. But the prophet takes up the words and he applies them back to the very people who were posturing in their confidence. And in Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 24 he says, therefore thus saith the Lord Yahweh of hosts, the mighty one of Israel, I will ease me of mine adversaries and avenge me of mine enemies. There will be no smug pride accepted by God simply because they were literal Jewish people. As far as that was concerned, they were like Sodom and Gomorrah, verse 9, if they did not do the things that God had asked. So, verse 25, I will turn my hand upon thee and purely purge away thy dross and take away all thy tin. This goes back again to verse 22, where we have that same expression of speech again. It's a reference in Ezekiel to the same kind of situation. Ezekiel chapter 22, I think it's verse 15, which again speaks to the purifying of the silver. And then it says, and I will restore thy judges as at the first, and thy counselors as at the beginning. So there was a promise to the what was the faithful city, verse 21, of being restored as at the beginning. Afterward thou shalt be called the city of righteousness, the faithful city. So verse 21 and verse 26 are very much related to each other. Zion, verse 27, shall be redeemed with judgment, and her converts with righteousness. And it's in chapter 2 and verses 1 to 5. That concept is magnificently developed. So we now run through verses 1 to 5. It shall come to pass, verse 2, in the last days, that the mountain of Yahweh's house shall be established in the top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. You know, it's a very treasured part of our understanding since we were little children. And a very rare understanding, I don't know why, that we've always known that on Jerusalem's height there will be a house of prayer for all nations. Why don't other people emphatically believe that? I've never been able to work that out. Isn't that clear as you could possibly make it in verse 2? They turn that into heaven and say it's above the hills. The whole sense of it's ridiculous, isn't it? As the verse itself goes on so well to say. That's a very clear vision which we ought to be very thankful to understand. You know, there are several passages which are very akin to that. There's one in Jeremiah. I know there's many that had to do with Jerusalem, but there's several that are very particularly clear. Jeremiah 3, verse 17. For anyone being baptized, this is just one of those key references that really has to be known. Jeremiah 3, verse 17. At that time they shall call Jerusalem the throne of Yahweh, and all the nations shall be gathered unto it, to the name of Yahweh, to Jerusalem. Neither shall they walk any more after the imagination of their evil heart. That's very, very similar to Isaiah 2, verses 2 and 4. Or again in Zechariah, chapter 14. Zechariah 14 and verse 16. It shall come to pass that every one that is left of the nations which came up against Jerusalem shall even go up from year to year to worship the King Yahweh of hosts and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. There's going to be a universal worship in Jerusalem, and Isaiah says that it will center around Yahweh's house. How thankful we can be to the work of Brother Sully. And it doesn't make any difference whether there's several details that are not exactly as they might turn out to be in the future. The fact is, we've been very blessed to have had in our very mind's eye, all of our life, a concept of a glorious house of prayer, elevated above the mountains, and Zion means, doesn't it? Elevated. It's a fulfillment of the vision of Zion. Elevated above the nations, and all the nations of the earth attracted to that. And that's exactly what Isaiah says in this chapter. There's no shadow of doubt about what he's speaking about. There is a house there, and there's the mountain of Yahweh's house. The house is not going to be set in the valley. It's going to be set in the mountain. It will be the mountain of Yahweh's house. It shall be established in the top of the mountains. Now, Jerusalem's always had mountains around about it. I suppose you've seen that, have you, in your pictures that you've seen of Jerusalem? If this is the roughly the shape of Jerusalem, then you've got mountains all around the city. So Psalm 125 depicts that. As the mountains are round about Jerusalem, so is Yahweh around about those who fear him. But in the future, it's portraying to us that the whole of this picture will be picked up and lifted up so that it will be a very clear vision to all people, never mind which direction they come from. It will be a centre of attraction to the whole earth. What a wonderful thing. What a fantastic thing. You know, there are some great cities in the world. One of the cities I visited last year was Paris. It is a fantastic city. It's full of interest. Every corner of Paris is rich with history and full of interest. Doesn't matter where you go. But it's on a river, isn't it? The River Seine. And it's low. Sometimes parts of it flood. Or there's Berlin. It's as bright and shiny as a new pin. Beautiful city. Rebuilt. So West Berlin is a beautiful city. I think the most beautiful city, frankly, is Canberra. That's been wrought by human hands. Magnificent city. Probably we don't realise that, do we? But it, Frank's Frank and Ezra in full agreement with that. But it is a very beautiful city, but it's nothing like this, is it? This is something that is so lifted up and placed upon the top of the mountain, that it's attracting people everywhere by its sheer unspeakable grandeur. And it says, in what is obviously against gravity, it says, "And all nations shall flow unto it." It's right up there, but all nations, like a great flowing stream, like a flood, are flowing unto it. And of course, that which flows normally flows downwards according to gravity. But here is the thing that is working against nature, against the natural laws. There is a spiritual pull which is drawing all nations against their own fleshly inclinations to go up to the place where the name of God will be. My dear brothers and sisters, what does that do to our hearts and minds now? Because that's an important question, as we shall see as we go on. It then says, "And many people shall go and say, Come ye, and let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh, to the house of the God of Jacob." Imagine a European saying that today. There's a basic anti-Semitism still right through Europe today, and it's even worse in Russia. "Many people shall go and say, Come ye, and let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh, to the house of the God of Jacob." They will know him as the God of Israel, the God of Jacob, and they'll want to go and worship him. You couldn't think of anything that's more against the grain today than that, could you? They might say it's the God of Jesus Christ, but the God of Jacob is something hardly that they want to wear. Now in the prophecy, perhaps we'll just finish the verse and then we'll go to Zechariah. It says, "And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths." The willingness of this verse is emphasized by many features. It's a spontaneous declaration. It's inviting other people to come with them. They want to be taught. That's why they're going. And they want to live what they are taught. "And we will walk in his paths. Out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." You know, my dear brothers and sisters, for all that we know that verse so much, isn't it a glorious verse? How do we come to Bible class tonight? Another very good question, related highly to the issues of verse 3. In what spirit and what attitude do we come to Bible class tonight? Because we know that Brother Rob's there with his book to tick off the names of those who attend? Or because it's the thing we do on Wednesday nights? Or because we really wanted to come and to learn? Because today and tomorrow we want to walk in his path. Well, in the future, all the nations, not just one nation that might be perhaps disposed, all the nations are going to react in that way. All nations, end of verse 2, shall flow into Russians, Romanians, whose history is stained with Jewish blood ever since they were a nation. Bulgarians the same. Germans, the whole lot of them, are going to flow to Jerusalem, and there will be the Jewish people in their cantons down that lane. And they will say, "Come," to other people. What does it mean that they shall say, "Come"? What's your picture? Come with me to Zechariah. Zechariah chapter 8. What a challenge is involved in these thoughts. This is going to happen. This is not theory. This is going to happen, and happen in the near future. And it has a tremendous exhortation to us as to how we ought to think about our service to our God at this time. In Zechariah chapter 8, the prophet is bemoaning the perfunctory religion of the people. They had all these fasts made up, but they really couldn't care an iota about keeping them. They were just on the religious program. And so they came up to the prophet and they said, How much longer do we have to keep this fast? And God comes at them. He says, look, you made up those fasts yourself. I didn't ask for them in the beginning. But he says, I tell you this, thus saith Yahweh of hosts in verse 19, the fast of the fourth month, and the fast of the fifth, and the fast of the seventh, and the fast of the tenth month, shall be to the house of Judah joy and gladness, and cheerful feasts. Therefore love the truth and peace. Have a bit of enthusiasm, says God, for what that which he has given you. When will that be? Turn back to chapter 8 and verse 3. You'll see that again we're tied into Isaiah chapter 2. For there it says, I am returned unto Zion, and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem shall be called a city of truth, and the mountain of Yahweh of hosts, the holy mountain. It's the same expression that we've got in Isaiah chapter 1, where it speaks about the faithful city. A city of truth. It's Isaiah's phrase. And it's at that time that people won't be shoved along to their fasts. They won't be going because it happens to be a date on their religious program. They will go because of gladness and cheerful feasts and joy in their service. Therefore, says Zechariah, appealing to the people, love the truth and peace, to walk in the ways that bring peace between brethren. Love the truth and peace. It's not a matter that is boring or difficult, it's because we love it. Our heart and our soul is behind it. This is what's going to be in the future. Thus saith Yahweh of hosts in verse 20, it shall yet come to pass that there shall come people and the inhabitants of many cities. See, this delegation that started this off, it come from Bethel. He says, you know, in the future, you're here bristling about the fact that there's a fast, you want to know how long it's going on. In the future, they'll come from many cities. Verse 21, and the inhabitants of one city shall go to another, saying, let us go speedily to pray before Yahweh and to seek Yahweh of hosts. And a voice of reply comes out of the crowd, I will go also. So he comes from one city, working its way along this little road that, of course, were in those times. And they burst into another city. It's a whole delegation from the other city. And they said, look, come with us. We're going up unto Jerusalem to worship Yahweh and to pray before him. And the people are shocked until eventually among them there is a voice saying, I will go also. And of course that city then joins with them. And there's a spirit of desire and enthusiasm to praise Yahweh. Verse 22, yea, says the prophet, expanding it now, not just in Israel with one and then with many cities, but many people. And not just the humble, weak ones. Many people and strong nations. The Russians and the Germans and the French and the English and the Americans, with all their pride and history, and many nations, strong though they might be, shall come to seek Yahweh of hosts into Jerusalem and to pray before him. Thus saith Yahweh of hosts. And the Jews were listening to this as Zechariah said it and thought to themselves, well, we weren't sure whether we wanted to come to this fast at all, and now you're telling us that all these people from many cities and from far off nations are going to come. Where do we stand in this? And Zechariah feels their importunity, and he says in verse 23, thus saith Yahweh of hosts, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men, that is to say all of men, shall take hold out of all languages of the nations, like Isaiah, isn't it? Even shall take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, that they'd spit at today, saying, we will go with you, for we have heard that God, the God of Jacob, is with you. What a wonderful prophecy. So there was the people standing in front of Zechariah, suddenly realizing that they were 1,000% out of phase with what God intended. What would happen if the nations from far came to them and said, look, we want to keep the fasts? They're sitting there grizzling about keeping one. You know, my dear brothers and sisters, there is to us a tremendous exhortation in that, isn't it? We should scamper home and we should write these things up and we should make them our mind and our heart. It's a very serious issue. For if we're dragged along to Bible class now, and we hope to teach the Jewish people, we will be in the vanguard of the whole of the kingdom. The nations will come to the Jews will come to us to learn of God's ways. What is it that we missed? Why didn't we read the record right? But if in this present time, my dear brothers, we're dragging ourselves along to Bible class, or if it's a weariness to come on Sunday morning, or if it gets a bit too tired on Sunday night, we're in a bad way, aren't we? And we can't fit into this. There's no use reading about Isaiah 2 anymore. We've got to pull ourselves up, because those who will be presiding in Isaiah chapter 2 in that house of prayer are going to be people whose hearts are lit by the love of God, by the power of his word, and by the wonder of all that he is doing in the earth. And if they're not there like that, they can hardly be involved, can they? For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem. We've got to know the word of Yahweh. We've got to love it and seek it. And in the various things that are prepared for us this year, in our class, in our camp, we're to throw ourselves into those endeavours and to be very slow, to be drawn aside to the other things which may take away precious time from those great and true interests that we have. And so in verse 4 he says, "And he shall judge among the nations and shall rebuke many people. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more." What an incredible statement. We are told that $1 million per minute is spent in weapons today. $1 million per minute. They shall learn war no more. There will be no need. Which, of course, in the days of Isaiah would have hit the king and his ministers with great force, for there was no need to go on increasing the number of armaments, the number of chariots, the number of horses, the number of weapons of war. There was no need for that. For if God was with them, they were well and truly protected. Let them get on and use those things to help the fatherless and the widow and so on. For in that day, they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Now you probably know that metal in those days was not as common as it is today. It's before they found those great big red mountains over in Western Australia and started cutting them all around the world. So what metal they had, they used therefore to use for several purposes. And when therefore they went to battle, they tended to take what metal they had, which would just be the little bit of metal they used for their plowshares, they would bend that into a weapon of war, that is, into a sword. So the picture has been historically seen that there is the plough bent like that, which when you unbend it becomes a sword. And that's the picture which is being portrayed here. And at the United Nations, the Russians in 1947, presented to the United Nations when they were yet in San Francisco, in a place called Flushing Meadow, they presented to the United Nations a statue which had a very burly man who was obviously a forger, I mean in metal, was a forger too. He was working this sword into a plowshare, and with his great strong arms he was pulling this heated metal, he was pulling it into a curve, so that it could be a plowshare. And the Russians, the atheists, presented that to the United Nations as a token of their interest and well-being in the institution of the United Nations. United Nations. When will the nations be united? This is the chapter that unites them, isn't it? All nations, verse 2, shall flow unto it, and many people shall go and say, "Come, let us go." There was from an atheistic nation a statue presented And the prophet quoted. In fact, they even put it into the first person. We shall beat our swords into plowshares. And while they said that, they went home and lighted up all their factories to make the increased number of tanks and weapons of every possible kind, and have done that from 1947 to 1990. And they still have not in any way increased their tremendous indulgence in the making of weapons of war. Such is the insincerity of the world, isn't it? That's how they would have brought about the United Nations. But this is the United Nations. You know, men have had another United Nations in time past, haven't they? The Tower of Babel. It was their design that it would attract all people, and it was very high that it might attract the attention of all people. It was a monumental failure. But in Acts chapter 2, there was a spirit that went forth that could speak in all nations, and it could overcome the confusion that was created at Babel in the beginning. That spirit was able to go to people of all nations. It's been calling people of all nations, even Australians, as it does even tonight, to come to a knowledge of these things, to love them with all of their heart, that they might be able in the precincts of this glorious house in the future to be able to take, whether it's a man, an Azerbaijan, or whether it's a Canadian, whether it's a New Zealander, or wheresoever he might come from, they'll be able to take him, and with that same spirit that began that work in Acts chapter 2, they'll be able to teach him the things of God's ways. It's a very good reason to know our Bible, isn't it? And to love our Bible, to teach our children about the Word of God, filling their hearts with it as often as we can, so that they at that time might be able, in the true day of the United Nations, to bring peace to the people, so that every man then might dwell under his vine and his fig tree. O house of Jacob, O house of Christadelphia, come ye and let us walk in the light of Yahweh. Thank you.